Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. And my guest this morning, a very special guest, Dr. Rustin Moore, the author of, and this is his most recent book, Unlocking the Bond, The Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions. Dr. Rustin Moore is, by the way, the Dean of the Rita Jean Wolf Endowed Dean, actually, of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. Good morning, Dr. Moore.
Good morning, Steve, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. And I'm curious, first of all, why did you... Now, the first book, which we spoke to you about when that book came out, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions, what is the difference between that book and this one, The Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions?
Great question. And the first book was really meant to be a foundational book that really described the history, the science, and the impact of the human-animal bond in a variety of situations. Book two, which is the Unlocking the Bond, the Power and Paradox, really is a continuation, because as I interviewed people, I started learning that there is the paradoxical side as well, where, let me give you just a couple of examples. I interviewed several incarcerated males at two different prisons in Ohio, and they were training dogs for various reasons and also rehabilitating injured or orphaned wildlife. And repeatedly, they said, in so many words, the animal rehabilitated me more than I rehabilitated the animal. And that's sort of a paradox that you might not imagine. Another one would be a section that I wrote around the bond between farmers and livestock, 4-H and FFA youth and livestock, and veterinarians and livestock. And that paradox is that, you know, while their animal is, they very well know what the animal is intended for, food consumption. Yet they love the animal dearly. They take great care of it while it's alive. They understand its purpose in the end. But it is sort of paradoxical, because in the end, that we know what's going to happen to it. And the final example I might give is a policeman or a military person who has a police or military dog, and they love that dog. That bond is stronger than you can imagine, and yet they put the dog in harm's way because that comes with the territory or the purpose. So that's sort of the difference in this book, that it highlights both the power of the bond, but also the paradoxical side of it.
Yeah, which is, and you give examples, very specific examples, and you tell stories. How often, let's see, for me, I'd say 3,998 times that just last year I heard from someone, I rescued a dog, but actually that dog rescued me. I suspect you've heard that, and you wrote about this, in fact. So let me ask you about that. Why is it, do you think, that not only dogs, but animals, and not only companion animals? You also write about horses in this book. So what is it about creatures with four legs that seem to be able to grab us in our hearts in a way that might be unexpected?
Yes, I think it's a multifactorial event or situation. I think it really how the animal responds to us, mirrors us. Horses in particular are exceptional at reading us and, you know, basically reflecting a mirror back to us. You know, with whether it's a companion animal, a dog has been rescued, you know, it's that feeling of purpose that we have maybe when we rescue it, but it also connects with us because it hasn't probably had the same level of human interaction as it would, you know, in your household. And we know that by interacting with animals, whether we're petting a dog, we're caressing a cat, we're looking in the eyes of a dog, we get a rush of oxytocin, dopamine, serotonin release. They do too. I just read something yesterday where scratching or rubbing a dog or a cat behind its ears is like giving it an emotional high, like a rush. So I think it's clearly bidirectional for both the animal and the person, and it can simply be visual. I mean, you can be sitting in an office watching fish, you know, swim through a tank, and it has a similar effect as it would if you're actually physically touching an animal.
Do you think that physicians ought to literally, for some individuals, for maybe loneliness, which is, according to our government, considered an epidemic, do you think that physicians, human physicians, ought to be able to write a prescription, although these days they type the prescription into a computer, but you know what I mean, and actually that our government ought to somehow pay for this prescription, although I guess that's a tough question because I don't know that any of our prescriptions are paid for often enough. But I think you understand where I'm going.
I absolutely do. Yes, I absolutely know what you're asking, and it's as if you have read my mind, because in book three, I've already written a whole chapter on loneliness and the benefit of, about the loneliness pandemic and how animals can have a positive impact on the lives of people who are lonely. And there is a difference between being alone and being lonely. Those are two very different things. And so I think absolutely. In fact, when I first did my TED talk on this topic in 2016 called The Power of the Pet, I actually talked then about medical professionals prescribing pets for various reasons, whether for physical reasons, emotional reasons, or whatever. So, yes, I absolutely believe they can and should, and some do, I understand. And the other part you ask is, should government or should insurance pay for it? And I actually think yes. And if we took a small amount and we were able to include the dogs in or our pets in family health insurance, I believe the healthcare costs of people would go down.
And actually, while that sounds crazy, we know that people are healthier if they have a pet. And for specific individuals, for specific issues, for example, I actually know of someone who had heart disease. The doctor wrote a prescription because this person was reluctant to go out and take walks. And that's what the doctor wanted him to do. He said, get a dog, and I will even write a prescription for you to adopt the dog. He did, and he did go out more often, and he was healthier as a result. We will find out if that's exactly what you mean. And I am curious about what you think about a new law that may be passed in Virginia having to do with what is up your alley, the human-animal bond. We'll be right back with Dr. Rustin Moore on WGN. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN, and he is a superstar in veterinary medicine, Dr. Rustin Moore, who is the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. And later in the conversation, I want to talk about the human-animal bond and veterinary medicine and the cost of veterinary care, which is something that may not be in the book, but something you have talked about at veterinary conferences and have come up with an idea, not you alone, you and others, but you tested, quote unquote, this idea. It's been successful. You know what I'm talking about. And it's all over the country now. But we were talking about doctors actually prescribing, get a pet. Unlike Prozac, and I'm not knocking Prozac, but there are no side effects to the drug, which is a dog or a cat, or for that matter, riding a horse. I mean, it is kind of a drug in a sense, isn't it?
It's definitely a form of therapy, treatment. In some cases, it's complementary treatment to some other approach that a human healthcare professional would prescribe, but definitely it should be something that should be considered. whether it's prescribed or amended. And, you know, you have to be cautious about it and make sure you get the right type of animal for, like, you know, if you're an elder person, you probably don't want a 6-month-old lab that's going to knock you over, or you probably don't want a little dog under your feet tripping you up. But there are dogs and cats and things that are appropriate for you. So, you know, you think about the environment you live in. Like, if you live on the 16th floor of a high rise, you in the fishing department, you probably don't want a Great Dane. But definitely there are positive aspects to it and minimal downside if you choose your pet correctly.
You know, in some ways, you don't sound like you're from Ohio. What I happen to know about you that I did not know until recently is that at one point in time, you lived near, and in fact, in Louisiana, and helped to rescue 500 horses after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Can you tell me about that?
Sure, absolutely. So in August of 2005, I actually was at home visiting my parents in West Virginia just by chance when Hurricane Katrina made landfall in New Orleans. I was scheduled to leave the next day and go back. I did, and I did get back into the airport in Baton Rouge. And then a day or two later, I got called down to Lamar Dixon Expo Center, which was sort of a holding facility for animals that had been evacuated before the hurricane. And I got called down there because people wanted me to go into New Orleans with some other veterinarians to rescue 2 or 3, 4 horses that day. And so I sped down there, got there, and I, you know, there were 5 or 6 equine veterinarians there. And I'm thinking, why do you need me? I mean, you don't need, you know, 6 veterinarians to go get a couple of horses. So I didn't go with them. They had enough people, and I stood back and talked to a couple of people, and I said, you know, if somebody doesn't take charge, get this thing organized, we're going to be in a real bad situation. I was not volunteering, but nonetheless, I ended up being the one that ended up organizing, rescue groups, trailers and all that, and making schedules. And all told, we did rescue and rehabilitate and actually rehome nearly 500 horses. So I would never wish that experience on anyone else, but I'm glad I had it because I saw the impact of the human-animal bond like none other, whether it was the people with their horses or even, you know, we rescued dogs and cats and other things. But it was impressive and emotional to see the bond those people had, whether they called worrying about where their horse might be or when they learned of its passing or when they were joined with it at the rescue center. It was just incredible.
Well, what the work you did there is incredible. That story is incredible. At that time, you were a faculty member at Louisiana State University, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. And now, of course, you're dean at The Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. So here's something that you mentioned, in fact, Virginia. In Virginia, there is a proposal that is already passed halfway through the bill unanimously passed the Virginia Senate. Now it goes on to the House. This bill, SB 261, would consider pets as family members in a more legal way. Now, right now in America, they are considered property or chattel, I think is the technical term. This doesn't put them on equal footing, this bill, as a human being, but it gives people more an opportunity to say my pet matters in a legal way. In addition, also, the penalty for malicious killing of a dog or cat would now be considered a Class 6 felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine up to $2,500, which for that state increases what it previously was. Now, you haven't looked at the law, and I'm catching you off guard, but at first glance or first sound of it, how does it sound to you?
Well, actually, I don't know that it's the first law, the first state. I'm pretty sure that some other states have similar laws that have been recently passed, including Pennsylvania and New York. But certainly, you know, you're absolutely correct that forever until recently, animals of all types were considered property, which basically means in the sense of if someone were to sue, say a veterinarian or anybody else, for that matter, or something that happened to their animal, maybe got hit by a car, maybe whatever, they could not sue for emotional damage, as one example. And this law may very well allow for that. But a lot of it has to do with people now understanding and believing that these animals are sentient beings. They can feel pain. They have emotions. And then in other states, Florida, where they passed Dexter's Law recently, that's because somebody had adopted a dog from a shelter and then, you know, just killed the dog, but in a very cruel way. And so, like the one you just said, states are enforcing, they're passing laws and enforcing them so that the penalty would be appropriate for the crime committed, up to, you know, in this case for Virginia, 5 years in prison.
Right. And I think Dexter's Law, is that Pennsylvania?
I think that's Florida.
Okay. Florida, you said?
Uh-huh.
Okay, that could be. Now, the difference here is, and you talked about paradox earlier, so why not have a law where pets are just equal in value to a human being? And I'll tell you, I have a concern about that. My initial concern would be, if that were the case, if the status was considered equal to humans with our litigious society, then veterinarians could be sued more easily for just about anything. That means the insurance cost, already going up and up and up, would go up even further instantly, passed on to pet parents, which means you'd all be paying more, which doesn't benefit our pets. Also, anyone could drag anyone into court with any lawsuit about a companion animal, and divorce cases. How would that be handled? So I want to talk to you about all of that, sort of the flip side of the coin. And we'll do that with Dr. Rustin Moore when we come back on WGN. I'm about to jump into the pool, into the deep end here. This is controversial in some places, what I'm about to talk about. I spoke about it at the two largest veterinary conferences in the U.S., one in January, that's VMX, that's the name of the conference in Orlando, Florida, and then the other at Western Veterinary Conference in Las Vegas, and that was in February. And that is this. There is never a justification for using a shock collar, sometimes called an e-collar, which is a more politically correct way of saying it. You're shocking the dog. Now, let me talk about it. It has been suggested over and over that, okay, you're right, Steve, unless it's a last resort to keep the dog alive. And I say, no, it is not acceptable as a last resort even, because we don't need it as a last resort. We don't need to hurt dogs to help them to, quote, get better. If we're talking about an aggressive dog, that dog is typically, not always, but typically aggressive because the dog is fearful. And now you're shocking the dog to get the dog to comply. But are you really addressing the underlying issue? And are you at all telling the dog or communicating with the dog as to what the dog should do, how the dog should respond? I say, if there's a last resort, I have a solution, and that is a veterinary behaviorist. Veterinary behaviorists have the expertise to assess the problem. They have all sorts of humane opportunities and choices in their toolbox, including psychopharmaceutical drugs, which there is nothing wrong with. And naturally, being veterinarians, they can discern if there is, and sometimes there is, an underlying medical issue which might be causing whatever is going on. If for some reason there is no veterinary behaviorist available, there are PhD animal behaviorists. There are certified dog behavior consultants, as such as myself, from the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants, none of whom would ever use shock as means to, quote, help dogs, because you're not helping the dog, not in reality. Interestingly enough, I thought, okay, I'm going to ask ChatGPT if I'm correct about this. And it turns out ChatGPT said what I just said, in essence, that no, there is a better way of doing it. Science around the world suggests there is a better way to do it. We do never need to shock our dog. Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. The book is a good one, Unlocking the Bond, the Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions. Dr. Rustin Moore is the author. He is the dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. And we were talking about a law that is kind of like writing a compromise, if you will, giving animals, as you mentioned, understanding that our pets are family members, and almost, it's no matter which survey you look at now, it's over 90% of pet parents feel that way. Pet parents has become a term that is, in fact, kind of an appropriate term to use. We feel that way about our pets. But on the other hand, if it were to go all the way, the other way legally, and pets had the same quote unquote, air quotes, rights as us, then there could be a side of the coin that actually I don't think is beneficial to pets or anyone else, Dr. Moore.
Yeah, it's a situation that certainly needs to be considered carefully. You know, if you think about owned animals, for example, who might for veterinary care, the owner is making a decision and agreeing to whatever procedures, et cetera, which is much like with an infant or a young child with a pediatrician. You know, there's real benefits to considering animals as a member of the family in a whole variety of situations, which we don't have time to go into. But there are potential downsides that we have to think about, and really that's along the lines of what you just said earlier about, okay, you know, let's say that a dog happens to die, veterinarian did no harm, was not negligent, but the dog died in this case, there's emotional stress, or maybe there was a medical error, and the dog died. And in the past, it would only be they could only sue up to the value of the animal, not based upon emotional distress. And you know, that's a hard thing for me to say is right or wrong. It's probably on an individual basis, but I think it's really important that when we think about these things, we think about all the possible scenarios and possible consequences, both positive and negative for both the animals and people.
I agree with that. And we live in such a litigious society. It would perhaps be different if we didn't, but we do. And right now, something else I want to talk to you about that I know is a huge concern of yours, and you've done something about it, and that is the cost of veterinary care. And now giving clients choices in a new way, I will let you talk about it.
Well, it's not specifically me. I mean, there's other people involved in this across the country in various ways. But, you know, we hear about these different terms. At Ohio State, we defined this back about 10 years ago as spectrum of care. We now hear phrases like access to care, contextualized care, et cetera. And really what it means is that we want to be able, as veterinarians, including our newly graduated ones, to have the confidence to offer a wide array or spectrum of medically acceptable options. And we need to talk with the client and meet them where they are, ask them what their expectations are, about what the outcome is. You know, I'll give an example. If a dog tears a cranial cruciate ligament in or their cranial cruciate ligament, there's a multitude of ways you can treat that. And if it's a three-year-old agility dog and the owner wants to return to athletic competitive performance, then one of these may be better than the other.
And I want to stop you just to explain. You're talking about a knee injury, but go ahead.
So if it's much like in a person that tears its ACL, so a knee, a ligament in the knee. But a dog that's, say, 12 years old, it's a couch potato, small dog, maybe that particular procedure isn't necessary. So it's really about offering an array of these various medically acceptable procedures and let the client make the decision without feeling any judgment or guilt. And part of that's based on finances and the cost, and part of it might be based on other things. But this is what we need to continue to do because the cost of care for veterinary care is rising.
It is, and I want to talk about that a little bit too, because veterinarians are taking a hit for that. And I suppose in some cases that may be warranted, having to do with practices that are across the country that are corporate and all that sort of thing. But by and large, veterinary practices, and I'll let you talk about this further, veterinarians have to pay rent or a mortgage like everyone else. The equipment cost, particularly with tariffs and such, have gone up. The cost of pharmaceuticals have gone up. The cost of help, the people to earn a living wage, has gone up. Everything has gone up, just like it's gone up for you and I when we go to the supermarket. I think that's a big part of it. Having said all that, the percent that it's gone up in veterinary medicine, the increase, has been an increase that is notably higher than the percent of inflation. Can you comment on that?
Sure. you're correct that, you know, inflation has gone up steadily, and medical inflation is higher than typically just gross inflation. And those things need to be taken into consideration. The other thing that people need to understand is that the cost to get a veterinary degree has also gone up substantially over the last 20 years. And part of that is due to less state support at veterinary colleges, which requires, therefore, tuition to go up to maintain the quality of the program to make sure it's accredited. So graduates have, you know, they 150,000, 200,000 median or mean debt from vet school, and it can go up to 300,000, 400,000. So they have to repay debt. And now with the federal loan caps, that's going to be even more of a problem. So, yes, costs have gone up and due to a variety of factors. And I'm concerned about that because I believe, well, I know that fewer and fewer people are going to be able to access that care because of the cost. So we have to have, and people are developing a variety of tools, whether it's care credit, whether it's other financial tools, payment plans and other things. And also a lot of people who have the financial means are donating to, say, colleges of veterinary medicine to provide for Good Samaritan care or for to help with the cost of care for pets that people who own them don't have the funds to pay for.
There's the pitch. Write Dr. Moore a note and say, here's a check for the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. We'll be right back with Dr. Rustin Moore, who is the author of Unlocking the Bond, The Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions. On WGN Radio, he is Dr. Rustin Moore. He is the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine at The Ohio State University. He has been the dean, I think, about 2015, something like that, Dr. Moore?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, Dr. Rustin Moore. His previous book, which we spoke to Dr. Moore about, I don't know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, Unleashing the Bond, Harnessing the Power of Human-Animal Interactions. Now he has another one out, Unlocking the Bond, the Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions. Well, to unlock the bond means what? So here's what I'm getting at. The good news, I think, is we do have more pets in this country by far than ever before. And while we have, in many places across America, a problem with too many dogs, especially large dogs in shelters, we do have more people overall, even though that is the case, going to animal shelters to adopt an animal. And then something magical happens that you and many others call the human-animal bond. And then we see human-animal interactions, including cases, and you write about many of these in the book, where a dog or a cat, or you write about goldfish even. Studies have been done about goldfish making a difference for people who, for example, have Alzheimer's. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, so going back to your original early question about unlocking the bond, that really refers to unlocking the power or the pleasantries or the benefits of what having a bond with an animal has on that individual or the family or a couple or whatever. It can have far-reaching effects. And it really, I always say that the human-animal bond is universal, but every bond is different. They're unique. And, you know, I have three dogs myself. I love them all. The bond is strong with all of them. Yet the bond is different because their personalities are different. So, you know, whether it's fish, whether it's a rabbit, whether it's a horse, whether it's a dog or cat, people do benefit from interacting with them and the bond that forms between them. And there's a whole biological and biochemical reason for it. A lot of research has been done, certainly supported by the Human-Animal Bond Research Institute and others, that shows these benefits on the animal as well as the person.
Right, and you write about that in your book as well, but also what you write about are animal-assisted activities, such as a dog going into a rehabilitation facility and working with the dog, in a sense, and the dog's handler, work with a medical professional. And the goal is to get that person to throw a tennis ball because that person may have had a spinal cord injury or a stroke. And even holding a ball seems to be difficult to do, if not impossible. And therapy just isn't doing the trick. However, in many cases, a dog might. And this is the kind of thing you write about in the book, and you use real life examples.
Yes. The approach I've taken with these books is really to raise awareness, which means informing, educating, but really to reinforce that with real life stories that show how this really works. And that's one of my dogs barking by in the background, if people are wondering.
That's on this program. That is okay. And demonstrates you really do have those dogs you say you have.
That's right. I do.
And they're I think they're miniature schnauzers, right?
They are black miniature schnauzers.
So they
Travis Tucker.
So they could be talk radio hosts as well. But go ahead.
Well, they have a voice in the book.
Yes.
I talk about the bond between a lot of different, including those people who have a service dog, prisoners who have the opportunity to take care of animals, and a variety of others. But here's an example that is, I'm not going to give a lot of detail because it'll be in a forthcoming book. But a person whose mother had attempted suicide and then became sort of catatonic, unresponsive, and I don't mean because they were in a coma, but just detached. From the family, wouldn't interact, whatever. The daughter described that to me as watching the mother eventually get out of bed and doing things, and that started by getting up to feed the two dogs they had. and really described those dogs, those two dogs, as bringing her back to life. I don't mean physically back to life, but functionally, emotionally back to life. That's the power, one example of the power of a pet.
Absolutely. Let me ask you a question. You go to swanky dinner parties. After all, you are the dean of College of Veterinary Medicine at The Ohio State. Notice how I say that correctly. The Ohio State University. And you're at that swanky party. You meet Gladys Smith. And Gladys Smith says, oh, you're the dean of the vet school? You say, yes. Vet school? I don't even like animals. What do you think of that person?
Well, you know, I mean, everybody is entitled to their opinions and their views, and some of that could be based upon they were just not raised around them, so therefore they're sort of foreign to them, or they had a bad experience when they were a child that they got attacked by a dog or whatever. So I personally don't pass judgment on it. I would probably try to, you know, have conversation about why they feel that way. Maybe they have allergies, maybe something else, but I would explain to them that there are, you know, major benefits to the health and well-being of individual or a family unit, whether it's in child development, other things. And that includes physical, social, behavioral, emotional, psychological, and mental health. So, again, I wouldn't judge. I would try to explain to them. And if they say, well, I'm allergic to dogs, I'd say, well, maybe you can think of a knot of dogs who are hypoallergenic or other ways that you can benefit.
Well, you know, I think 76 or 77% of the population in the U.S. currently have a pet. And for the population that doesn't, people in the immediate family, sons or daughters or grandchildren, et cetera, are likely to have a pet, and those people interact with their pets. So most people today in the U.S., and to my knowledge, our government has not said you must have a pet. Pets are a commitment. They cost some money. They cost us time. People yet choose to make this decision. And not only in America, this is much of the world. So to me, there's got to be a reason why people do choose to make this decision.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's a global phenomenon. And as an example, one example, in South Korea, more pet strollers are sold per year than baby strollers.
I happen to know that. So he's correct about that. The name of the book, Unlocking the Bond, The Power and Paradox of Human-Animal Interactions. Like his first book, this is a good one, too. You can get this book, Unlocking the Bond, by Dr. Rustin Moore, wherever you get your books. Dr. Moore, always a pleasure to talk with you. Statistically, over 90% of pet parents think of pets as family. However, by law, pets are legally chattel or property. Having said that, in recent years, many judges have leaned toward considering the emotional attachment people have with their pets. Still, they must stay within the law. However, Virginia may change that. They're opening the door to do just that, recognizing legally pets in a special category. Not quite the same with the legal rights as humans, but more so understanding that they are emotional beings and understanding that they are family. This law will also offer a penalty for malicious killing of a dog or cat, which would now be a Class 6 felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of up to $2,500. So far, this law is passing. It hasn't yet, but it looks like it might. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.